Welcome to DevMode.fm, a podcast dedicated to the tools, techniques, and technologies used in modern web development. I'm Andrew Welch from NY Studio 107.
I'm Jonathan Melville from MDD in Atlanta.
I'm Marian Nulevant here in Portland, Oregon.
I'm Michael Roggs, sweating it out in Houston, Texas.
And I'm Patrick Harrington from Mildly Geeky in Boston.
And today we have on Sam Hernandez, the front-end architect at Percosity LLC. How you doing, Sam?
Great. Woohoo.
Wow, that's a fancy title.
Isn't it?
My goodness. You might even say that's a precocious title.
precocious at Percosity. I'm gonna drop that in Slack.
Yeah, you can steal that. So, Sam, we want to talk to you today about something called stoicism. So if you are out doing a photo shoot at Club Marcella at a drag show, and the next drag queen was about to come out, someone turns to you and says, "Hey, Sam, what is stoicism anyway? And what does it have to do with development?" Like, what would you say?
That's like quite a scenario right there.
Well, I mean, hurry up, because the next performer's coming out, the music's going to start. So you don't have long to kind of give them something.
Okay, so it's a coherent philosophy of life that you can live by that is intended to give a person a sense of equanimity in life, which is serenity, peace, and even joy, you would say. So I think at the end of the day, that's probably the elevator pitch right there.
Well, everything I know about stoicism, I learned from PewDiePie, the famous YouTube streamer. He did a little stream on stoicism, believe it or not. Like, I was shocked.
I was shocked to know that.
Yeah, I was shocked. On April 29th this year, actually, he did it. So I was surprised to see that, but it was actually pretty cool and it was pretty well done. And obviously he's going to be hitting a very different demographic than most of the people here, you know, kind of revolve in. So it's kind of interesting.
Very concerned about your YouTube habits.
What's wrong with PewDiePie, man?
Anyway, that's another podcast.
Oh, we got to get into what's wrong with him. All right. Isn't he like the biggest? He's the biggest streamer, though, isn't he?
Yeah, he's just like an awful biggest person.
Isn't he still like demonetized, though? Or is that still the case?
I have no idea. Yeah,
and I think he's the biggest individual streamer. I think there's an Indian from India media outfit that surpassed him. But see, anyway,
Sam, I really feel like Patrick could benefit from some of the stoicism, because his first thing that he does whenever you mention anybody is he does a character assassination on the person. He just ignores.
No, I'm just concerned about your YouTube habits, and ignores, I worry about what is in my control, and I feel I can help to control your YouTube habits. So he ignores
the message and immediately just goes for a character assassination kind of deal. So how could stoicism help Patrick? How can we help? our friend?
Patrick might be beyond help at this point. I can't make any guarantees.
No, but seriously. So what I remember about stoicism, I used to conflate Spartanism and stoicism to some extent, right? When I was first thinking about stoicism again, I'm like, oh, those are the guys that sleep on the floor. I'm like, well, no, wait a minute. Those are the Spartans, like the warriors, right?
Yeah.
So how were the Stoics, were they warriors as well, or what was their deal?
No, Stoicism. Well, first of all, I just want to preface to and set expectations properly is that my interest in Stoicism is not academic. In fact, I'm not an academic in any sense. So maybe I would expect that Marian would know something about Stoicism because she's educated. Please fill in the gaps for me. But when it comes to history, the stuff that I've read, Stoicism was started, of course, in Athens, Greece, where you had all of your other philosophies, schools of philosophy. But this was back in a time when schools of philosophy were not intended to be necessarily academic. I think the beginnings of logic and things like that were happening at the time. But Stoicism is more a way of living. So if you adhered to a particular philosophy, you called yourself that thing, sort of like religions today. Like you might call yourself a Muslim or a Christian or whatever religion of your choice. And that's how you identify. And it gives you some sense of like a moral framework or any type of framework. That's what Stoicism gives you is a practice. But these days, philosophy is largely an academic endeavor, right? It's something that you learn in university, and the people who study it tend to be smarter than me. So that's just not it at all.
The only thing I know is I looked up Stoicism, and the etymology is something that always interests me. And apparently it means porch. Like that is the root word Stoic comes from the Greek stoa.
Stoa, of course.
Which, Oh yeah, of course, Marion. You just made everyone listening, including myself, feel dumb. Like, of course.
You just have to say, "Of course," in the right tone of voice. That's all you have to do.
Yeah, to sound smart. Of course.
When you think of Stoicism, I did not know that. But when I think of Stoicism, the porch scene sort of makes a little bit of sense, because Stoicism sort of wants to take on this aesthetic of a sort of grateful, confident indifference, and that's kind of. And I don't know, when I picture like myself sitting on a serene porch, I'm on my rocking chair with my, you know, cup of sweet tea, and the breeze is blowing and the world could be ending across the street, but I'm just sitting on my porch, sipping my sweet tea in my rocking chair and
watching the world end.
Like in Athens? Yeah.
I don't think they had porches in
that was in southern Athens. Well, they had southern Athens. That's
Athens, Georgia.
Yeah, he's out there with his sweet tea on his rocking chair in the, on the this porch. But yeah, apparently, let me just read like real quick what it's saying. It says it means from Stoa, which means porch, specifically Stoa Poikile or Poikile or something, which means the painted porch, the great hall in Athens. You know, if you picture those great halls, is kind of what they're talking about. And that's where a school was that a philosopher named Zeno taught. And I guess they just kind of named the philosophy after the porch on the way into where he taught it, I guess, is what it sounds like.
Yeah,
I don't know.
That's pretty cool.
But anyway, let's talk about how Stoicism pertains to development, first of all. Because, you know, most people on here are developers or designers or whatever. How is Stoicism something that could be relevant to us? And I know you did a talk at the 2019.all conference about the Stoic developer. But so for people who haven't heard that, and also just to elaborate on it, how can Stoicism help us as developers?
Well, you know, that's a really good question. I don't spend a lot of time thinking about how it applies to development. The talk that I gave was just an excuse to talk about Stoicism in general, but I can think of several examples. Okay. So here I am practicing Stoic. I can tell you the history of how I arrived here, but there was a time, and Mark Hewitt will tell you, probably he might remember this, when I was during my Happy Cog days, where I just complained about everything, especially indentation. And
you complained about everything?
Well, not everything. I might exaggerate once or twice.
I was going to say, you sound like the embodiment of Twitter.
pretty much. But yeah, but okay. So take something as simple as indentation. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to out myself here. I'm somebody who would get upset about it. And I remember complaining to Mark one day that I hate spaces. I wanted tabs because I wanted my own thing. I didn't like two spaces. And then he's like, well, what do you prefer, four spaces? And I thought about it and I was like, no, I actually really hate four spaces too, but three spaces doesn't make any sense. So I just hate it all.
Okay.
Yeah. That is a hard way to live.
Yeah.
That's a hard way to live.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's like you can throw yourself into that fight and possibly make the world slightly better by having three spaces in some places, or make the world slightly worse by having three spaces in some places. But it doesn't sound like a really useful and fulfilling thing to do with yourself.
Or you could make all of your coworkers miserable by complaining constantly. You know, I mean, exactly. I tell my kids that complaining is like farting in a crowded elevator. You know, like nobody enjoys that experience.
It's like what Marcus Aurelius says: what's bad for the hive is bad for the bee. You know,
I thought you were going to tell me that Marcus Aurelius talked about farting in an elevator.
I'm not getting in any elevators with your kids, Andrew.
I mean, in so many words, that's kind of the same thing. You know,
yeah, it is.
That was in his famous treatise on gastrointestinal issues.
Yeah, I remember that one. That was a good one. But to answer your question, I mean, back to the point, like, so that being one story, that's kind of a comical something. But I was just talking with another developer yesterday who was telling me about, we just actually got into a conversation talking about this and that. And he was telling me how he was a Java developer before. And his experience, at least the place where he worked, the senior Java developers were not, well, basically unfriendly. And you can imagine how that story goes: unhelpful, unfriendly, thinking that you should already know these things. And the way that I had a talk with another developer once about this, and these are not my words, these are his description, but you know, the neckbeards in the closet type of developer who...
It's a thing. Like, I've seen neckbeards. Like, it's a thing. Just saying.
It's a thing,
nowadays,
right?
Nowadays, they work in barns, but...
It's a thing.
Same. You could say something about me. You can say whatever you want, but I do shave the beard on my neck.
We appreciate that.
Yeah.
Yeah. But here's the effect of that, right? Great that you know all your design patterns and you know all this stuff, but you're making other people miserable.
Right.
So a really relevant topic that gets discussed often on Twitter is, should you hire that really great developer who's a toxic person? And the answer is no.
Absolutely not. We talked about this too, when we're talking about like traits to be a good developer and everything. And I think there are lots of traits that at least I think most people think are not great that could be good for being a great developer. But if you're just a shit to work with, like, I don't care how good you are. Like, I'm not going to hire you. Like, why would I do that? Because a lot of the job, no one is so good that it outweighs the collectivism that you really need to produce a good project, at least in my opinion.
Absolutely. I've been around long enough to see how morale affects productivity and can affect the success of a project.
Right. No, totally, I agree. And if you go into work, so, you know, they've done studies where what people really want is to feel that they're doing meaningful work. There's a certain amount of money that you need to make. And then after that, there are diminishing returns in terms of your happiness from it. But what people really need to feel happy is that they're doing meaningful work. And if you're going in there and you just hate the environment or you hate interacting with most of the people you work with, oh God, it's just, that would be awful. I would hate that.
Mm-hmm. Now imagine if this scenario had been different for this gentleman and everybody at the company that he had this bad experience at was a stoic.
Mm.
So now you have these ideas of wisdom, temperance, courage, justice. Well, how about this? How about sympatheia? The idea that we're all part of nature, that we're interwoven, and that humans were created for each other and that we're here to help each other. And also there are things that, another idea being like the dichotomy of control. There are certain things that you can't control, certain things that you can, right? So if you have a senior developer now and the way I like to frame it is a phrase that I heard a long time ago, your chin up, but your nose low, right? Mm. Like you do have all the confidence that you know what you know, but your nose is low, you're not snobby, and you will take the time that you do have to help your junior developers understand without making them feel like pieces of crap. And so now you have, and then also as a developer, I think you can become overwhelmed when learning new technologies. We talk about that a lot, like learning fatigue. And say you're that junior developer who's trying to learn, all those moments of frustration could be put into perspective by understanding like, hey, this is just something that I don't know yet. And that's an idea of just acceptance, you know, to relax, you don't know it yet. You can ask questions because you're not concerned about your ego so much or your reputation.
And that's something that I think is interesting. So something that is really big in the development world for whatever reason is this idea of imposter syndrome. And I don't really get it. And the reason I don't really get it is that I am constantly on a daily basis doing things that I don't know how to do. Like, it's just like, that is almost the definition of the work that I do. I mean, sure, as you gain experience, you're able to do this, that, or the other thing. But the things that I find interesting are challenges where I don't know how to do the thing, right?
Yeah.
So if you're doing development work, you're going to spend a huge chunk of your time not knowing how to do the thing that you're trying to do. Why feel bad about it? That's part of what you're supposed to be doing.
There might be some context though. Like, what do you think about this? You are kind of an independent and set your own hours. If you are a developer at a company and you're on a ticket on Jira that you've estimated and you're going way over, there could be a certain amount of anxiety of being perceived as an underperformer. The idea that the project manager is looking over your shoulder and thinking that you're a loser, you're going to lose your job, and that kind of anxiety. And also, even in my work, it's like what I'm doing right now. I'm having to learn a lot on the fly. I'm having to spend evenings sometimes, you know, doing it. But I think there's that element where there's some anxiety around it. But even that can be mitigated with a proper outlook.
Yeah, I will tell you that, you know, obviously I have felt that way about certain problems. I think everyone has. You have to, because if you're doing anything remotely complicated, it's almost like you don't even know where to start on it and it just feels overwhelming or whatever. I have found that it is never as bad as I make it out to be if I just start going in and doing it. And there's nothing like getting your hands dirty.
I don't have much more to add than I agree with that 100%. There's been so many times where I think the more time you sort of spend debating how to begin tackling something, the chance for the boogeyman to grow in stature in your mind is greater versus if you just jump in and take action and start tackling it, more than likely you're going to find that it wasn't nearly as bad as you had imagined.
So, I mean, perfect example. I have been doing some stuff in Go lately, and I've been doing it accidentally because I offered to help somebody out and I got something up and running. And then they're like, oh, well, could it do this and could it do that? And I'm just like, I guess, like, I don't know. I don't know anything about Go, but all right. And so I put it aside for a day or two, just thinking about it. And I was just like, oh, man, you know, I don't know anything about this thing. And it kind of was weighing on me a little bit. But then I just started like playing with it. And it really wasn't that bad. Like, it really wasn't, you know, at some point, you just got to do, you know, some of these tropes or sayings or whatever, like the journey of a 1,000 miles starts with a single footstep. I mean, it's a thing, you know, just start walking and you're going to get somewhere.
But Andrew, it does happen to at least some other people that they are legitimately in over their heads on something or
right.
other. And I
think we're speaking, all of us are speaking about this from a position of great privilege as relatively senior developers and folks who have been in the industry for a long time. I think that there are people who are in situations where that imposter syndrome is going to weigh on you more heavily because it is more tied to your survival in the industry and your income, your ability to provide for yourself and your family. But then,
I think
it's important to have what Sam is calling like this proper outlook, I think you said, from the start, because we're all sort of talking around it. But Sam, you mentioned those cardinal virtues of wisdom, courage, justice, and temperance. Maybe it'd be worth it for us to kind of like take a step back for a second and define what those are, since we're all sort of talking about them and how they apply to us, but we haven't actually said what they are yet.
Sure. Yeah. I have actually a mind map in front of me because I didn't want to remember. I didn't want to forget anything. But you see, that's important too, because Stoicism is full of a lot of maxims, right? That will help you, little gems that you can hold on to, and they might make you feel a little better in the moment. But I don't think, at least in my experience, that Stoicism helps as much as it would if you actually adopted it and actually marinated it and like committed to it for a year or something. So the idea of wisdom. So let's talk about wisdom. Just 30 seconds on wisdom. The good news about wisdom is that it's not tied to a high IQ. And a good example of that would be like Forrest Gump, right? You don't have to be smart to be wise.
And I know a lot of very smart people who are not wise at all.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So wisdom and intelligence are, they might be tied and overlapped. I'm not a psychology expert, but with wisdom, that's where in the scope of wisdom in Stoicism, that's where you get into the dichotomy of control. You know, there are things that you can control and things that you can't. Epictetus defined those as very clearly. It's not like secret hidden wisdom. The things that you can control are your actions. And the things that you can't control, he says, are pretty much everything else.
Mm.
And your actions are precipitated by your decisions. Your decisions are precipitated by your perceptions. And if you can control your perceptions of things, that will end up with better actions. And when I like an old saying that I heard in 12-step recovery, saying that you get what you got when you do what you did. So the wisdom is the key to living a better life with better results. Temperance would be simply self-control, curbing your desires, all things in moderation. I think there's an old Roman proverb that said too much or too little of anything ruins it. Courage would be like the courage to face misfortune. You could think of courage as resilience, even the willingness to face death with dignity and holding on to your principles no matter what. And then justice, I like what Marcus Aurelius says about justice. He says, not to be driven, and this is a quote from him, not to be driven this way or that, but always to behave with justice and to see things as they are. And he expands on that, saying that injustice is like blasphemy against nature. And he makes this argument about, a perception anyway, that nature is justice. And well, anyway, I'm going to ruin this. I'd have to open up a book. But the idea is that there's no justice without truth. And so it's important to understand what the truth of things are too. He says that what is, like nature is what is, and what is not far off from what is the case in any given case. And so you can't have justice without knowing what the truth is. And I would add to that, it's hard these days to know what the truth is about things without researching and taking the time and the effort and the responsibility to research things before you echo things that aren't, might not be true. So that's justice. And justice includes the idea of sympatheia. The universe is interwoven. You and I, all of us on this podcast, we were all made to help each other and to serve each other. And that's a responsibility that we have because, like Marcus Aurelius said, what's good for the hive is good for the bee. So yeah, those are those four in a row.
Yeah. And something you mentioned earlier is that there are lots of little nuggets of information that you can use and will be valuable to you, but you might want to try living these values as opposed to kind of using them like fortune cookie fortunes.
Yeah.
So what does that mean? Because it's great to have little quotes that help remind us and center us and that kind of thing. But what's the difference between just digesting these little fortune cookie nuggets of wisdom versus actually living the thing?
Yeah. The Stoics. So there are a few things, and I grabbed my talk that I gave at Montreal at .all. I pretty much ripped off step by step a book by William B. Irvine, and it's called A Guide to the Good Life. And he talks about these things in terms of Stoic or psychological techniques, but I would call them practices. And that's why I say, whenever I say I'm a Stoic, I'm not so much into Stoic philosophy as much as I'm into Stoic practice. It's the practices of Stoicism that give me a better life. So one example, like I gave at the talk, was memento mori. Remember that you're mortal. And the way that I do this intentionally. In fact, just yesterday, I was talking with my wife. She is 14 years younger than I am, and it's very likely that I'll pass before she does. And long
Sam, robbing the cradle. My
I know.
Goodness.
I know. Wow. I tell you, it just worked out that way. But we even talked just yesterday about what would happen if I would pass, like what does our bank account look like? What is she going to do? And all that stuff. So it's not that it's going to, it promises that the future is going to be any, it's going to feel any better for her if that happens, but to remember that you're mortal and also plan for the future. Actually, I'm kind of conflating memento mori with premeditatio malorum, which is to imagine the worst thing that could possibly happen in the future. But
which is the opposite of YOLO, right?
Exactly. But but remembering that you could, like Marcus Aurelius said in his journals, he said, remember that you could leave this life right now and let that determine what you say, think, and do. And he also says, live your last day every day. Mm. To not live in frenzy, sloth, or pretense.
I worry about that, though. I worry, like, if we all actually lived our every day, like it's our last day on Earth, I honestly really worry what would happen. You know what I mean? I think there would be a huge increase in crimes. Let's put
it
that way.
Have you seen the movie Purge?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Okay. I don't know, though. I don't think it's so opposed to sort of, like you said, it's the opposite of YOLO, but I think it's exactly YOLO, but it's sort of right. a more self-knowing YOLO. Right. Because like a key thing about, a useful thing for me, considering like these tenets of Stoicism, is each virtue is directly opposed to a potential vice. And so this virtue of sort of understanding your morality and consideration for the things which could happen is opposed to the vice of irrational fear and the unreasonable and harmful things that one can do when one is acting out of irrational fear. And so to consider the worst that could happen and decide that the thing that you want to do is worth that risk or is mindful of that risk and deciding to do it anyway because it's worthy, better considered version of YOLO. It's I have applied caution, but I have stopped short of fear and I have decided what I'm going to pursue and I'm going to pursue it with courage.
And it also sort of reminds me of those, was it Roosevelt's quadrants of making sure that you're conscious of the things that are very important, but not urgent, because we tend to focus on only the things that are urgent.
Yeah. I think that this is a little bit of a tangent, but you bring up a really good point. There are concepts like what at first glance, you kind of filter them through your own filter, or we all have our individual like moral taste buds, so to speak. And maybe the initial thought of like memento mori or premeditatio malorum might not taste so good right away. But, and that's why I think like, if you really want to get into Stoicism, give it 6 months of actually reading a bunch, because you'll find the balance for whatever you're having a problem with at the moment in learning Stoicism. There's something over there on the right that you haven't seen yet that balances it out. Right back to what Michael was saying.
I want to correct myself real quick. I looked it up. It's actually Eisenhower decision matrix, not Roosevelt.
Important and unimportant, urgent and not.
Yeah.
Urgent.
Exactly. And in this case, actually, what really is important is the concept, not the person that did it, right? So this kind of gets back to what you were talking about with your, how many should we use tabs or spaces? You know, from my perspective, like, I don't really care. Like, I really honestly just don't care. All that matters is that in your organization that you work within, you standardize on something. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Like, to me, that's what matters. And I don't get on that particular argument. I don't get hung up on it. I'm just like, okay, you know, whatever.
Well, or you focus on what you can control and you don't cast your own craving as, you know, as requirement on someone else. Maybe that means your org standards on tabs, because tabs are superior and everybody knows it. But maybe someone in your organization disagrees with you, in which case, okay, well, what can I control? Well, I can.
And how much does it matter?
Build step on my right. So first is it worthy? Does it matter? And if I decide that it is worthy, then it's probably going to be not because I have an emotional reaction to it, because I let myself sit with that and then I decide, okay, that's an emotional reaction. This is not rational. But maybe I still decide that it's costing me enough time, it's costing me enough productivity that I need to use one thing or another because I can be more productive. And then I need to set up a little build step on my end that when I open a file, it changes spaces into tabs. And when I recommit that file, it changes them back to whatever is standard for my org, because I can control that. And so I can get the benefit that I need without imposition on other people based on my emotions.
Yeah. And this kind of reminds me of something that Sam alluded to earlier, which is the serenity prayer. I think the context I know it from is Alcoholics Anonymous or whatever. In the beginning is, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Would that be considered a Stoic philosophy, Sam?
Indeed. In fact, I'll just tell you that that's my history. I came into Stoicism through the side door. And in this, and I kind of wanted to share this with y'all anyway, just in the spirit of understanding that in our industry, well, in many industries, but I'm only aware of ours, that there are a lot of people who share about their mental and emotional disorders or struggles that they have in hopes that other people who might suffer from that might gain some encouragement or direction, right? So, right. But that's actually my history, is 12-step recovery. There was a time when I was sitting with what we call a sponsor, who's like a mentor, and we were reading some of the literature, and it was about ego and all this stuff. And he looked up at me and he said, you know, all that we're learning here is Stoicism, right? And I didn't know anything about philosophy, Stoicism, or anything. So I didn't know at the time, but it was just a few years ago that Ryan Ireland, our good friend, mutual friend, recommended. He said, dude, you might like to read Ego is the Enemy by Ryan Holiday. It's a really good book. And that's how I was actually introduced to Stoicism, just maybe 3 years ago. And so my sponsor back in the day was absolutely right. And what's interesting is that because of my experience, I don't have, and I'm just going to be very candid with you, Stoicism isn't just like a passing interest to me, or its Stoic practices aren't. In my particular case, and I'm not unique in this, is that my actual literal life depends on this in some regard, at least the shortening of my life. And so me keeping a sense of serenity and equanimity and service to each other is something that is not optional for me. And so I feel like that's a benefit, however. But what's beautiful is that I think I have a better life now than I would have if I had never had the struggles that I had. And I've always wanted to find a way to share this with other people. And the beauty of Stoicism is that it's not a religion and it's not 12-step recovery. It's not any of those things. It provides a common language that I can share these concepts with other people, hopefully, to gain the benefit of the same kind of life.
Yeah, that's actually really interesting to me. It reminds me of an old fantasy book that I read a long time ago called The Chronicles of Thomas Covenant. And I'm not expecting anyone to have read it, but the reason it reminds me of that is that the main character had leprosy. It was a condition that he had to live with. And as part of that, he lost the sensation in his limbs. So he couldn't tell when he injured himself. So in order to live, in order to get through his daily life, he adopted a protocol of what he had to do to check himself at every instance to make sure that he had not harmed himself in some way. And it sounds kind of philosophically similar to what you're talking about.
Oh, most definitely. Most definitely. Yeah. So I practice these things every day. I spend time, and it doesn't take a lot of time, you know, premeditato, like thinking about what could go wrong in the future. It doesn't take a lot of time to do that. There's also anchoring, you know, anchoring your expectations, being grateful, thinking, well, I'm grateful for what I have because actually my life could be a lot worse right now. I could have nothing, right?
Right.
And honestly, there are so many things about the time in which we live that we're just so much more fortunate than people in the past 100 years. I mean, up until the last 100 years, human existence was marked by mostly by poverty and suffering and like abject poverty and disease and suffering. Many things that within just the last 100 years that we're fairly wealthy and well off now. But if my expectation is, well, I could have been born at any other time, so I'm just glad to have the healthcare I have right now or whatever, you know? But anyway, I'm kind of rambling on that now.
Well, let me ask you a question. So this might be somewhat controversial. So we'll see how it goes. Patrick is probably going to freak out.
Get ready, Patrick.
Oh, boy.
You ready, Patrick?
Uh-huh.
So there's a meme that's going around about the Karen, right? So the Karen is, you know, typically middle-aged white woman who complains about everything. Some people say it's a misogynistic term or whatever. But the point is, you know, someone who's just never happy with what's going on and is constantly complaining, wants to see the manager, you know, that kind of thing. What could a Karen learn from Stoicism, Sam?
Well, a Karen, so that is exactly the thing. A Karen would need to learn that the life they're living is a hard life to live. Something that I always am fond of saying, like, that's just a hard way to live.
Yeah. And why do you want to make things hard on you? Things are hard enough already. Like, why make it worse, right?
I don't understand psychology. It's sort of a human thing. I think we love misery. I don't want to say we love misery. That's such a terrible generalization, but it was my experience, you know?
Mm.
So, but the answer is, if you want a better life, then you have to have a better mind.
Mm.
But the requirement to want a better life, that's not a requirement. Like, either do or don't. It's up to you. The life you live is on your own. And that's definitely a Stoic thing too, is that a Stoic doesn't care if other people aren't Stoic. In fact, we expect most people in the world to be a Karen in the way that you described it right there. Expect that if a bad thing happens to me, like, here's an example, if a bad thing happens to me, to be glad about it, because if it happened to somebody else, they might not be able to handle it. You know, it's that kind of
thing. Yeah. Well, what you said just reminded me of another maxim that I heard a long time ago. And I'm going on fortune cookie wisdom, but this was in terms of being physically in good shape, is that your body reflects your lifestyle, right? There are lots of people that, like, they want to go on a diet. They want to do something to change something about themselves. But really, your body directly reflects what you do as part of your lifestyle on a daily basis. So if you want to change the way your body looks, you can't just do these little fad things. You have to change your lifestyle. You know, you have to get out, you have to exercise, you have to make it a daily part of what you're doing. And you're essentially saying the same thing, but regarding your mental attitude. And that makes complete sense to me. Yeah,
exactly. And most people are not going to get it, I think, because a change like that, like somebody who has already trained their mind over, who knows, 20 years of life to think a certain way, you kind of get in that rut. The impetus to change is not there unless you hit a bottom. And so my story, or any number of people who have that identical story, where life gets so bad that you finally have your existential crisis, you realize that you weren't able to live life on life's terms, and then you find a reason to get better. But what happens, I think, to a lot of people is that people can just generally be unhappy through their life, never sick enough to find a doctor or even know that they need to find a doctor.
And this actually gets back to what we were saying before, where I was saying that imposter syndrome, no big deal or whatever, and I got some pushback from Marion and some other people about it. But what I mean is, if you accept that part of your job is not knowing what you're doing, then you shouldn't feel bad when you are in a situation where you don't know what you're doing. And yeah, you can be in a situation where you're a junior developer. I'm a junior developer when it comes to Go right now. Like, I'm as junior as it gets. Like, no one would probably hire me to do anything with Go. But what you have to be able to do is accept that this is normal. Like, put your ego aside. It's normal that you're going to encounter things that you don't know what you're doing, and then ask somebody for help. You know, if you're in that situation where you're evaluated, you've got the Jira ticket, like you were saying, and it's got to be done in a certain amount of time, and you don't really know what you're doing, obviously put in your best efforts to figure it out, but then ask somebody. And don't let your ego get in the way of that, because you got to understand that there are things you're going to encounter as part of your daily job that you're just not going to know how to do. I do it all the time. Like, I leverage people that have specific spheres of knowledge that I don't have, and I talk to them all the time about stuff, and they talk to me. You know, we do like skill swapping type of things all the time. What do you think, Mary? Am I still kind of head in the clouds with imposter syndrome? Am I simplifying it too much?
A little bit.
Yeah.
I think that if imposter syndrome is worrying that you might be in over your head when sort of pointless because you're not in over your head, but pointless because the worrying about it isn't the solution. If you're in over your head, then, you know, you need to do something about it, but worrying about it isn't going to help.
But yeah, isn't that what Sam is talking about in terms of rearranging your mental model and accepting that that is a thing and doing something positive rather than just worrying about it?
Right. I agree. I think so. I think the positive thing to do about it may be to, you know, leave that job and move on to one where you're not being billed as a senior Go programmer when that really isn't you.
Right.
Well, I mean, you said it very interesting. You said two key things, Andrew. First, you said you have to accept that this is part of your job. This is normal. Yeah. This is the way of things. And then you said, and you have to set your ego aside. Mm-hmm. And both of these are deeply stoic things to say, because the setting aside of ego is like, ego is sort of that about yourself that prevents you from seeing yourself clearly. And that the danger of ego is that it prevents you from having a conversation, an honest conversation with yourself about things like justice and prudence. And so in order to accept that something is normal or expected, you have to first be able to realize it. You can't accept something that you don't realize. And I think that's what's really useful about the framework of Stoicism. And I actually really want to go, what did you say the books, the Chronicles of who?
Oh, you want to read the book, The Chronicles of Thomas Covenant.
Yeah, like this idea of self-examination, whether you're, you know, going through the protocol to check yourself for leprosy or like physically, or you're doing it on a more spiritual, philosophical, logical plane, in order to, when you're in that situation of feeling over your head, in order to accept the reality, you have to confront, like, what is my actual situation? What am I actually afraid of? What am I actually afraid of? What are the actual consequences? How can I mitigate these consequences? And times, if you ask yourself those questions honestly, then what am I afraid of? Well, I'm afraid of being a fool. Well, what are the consequences of looking like a fool? Well, you know, everybody's a fool in some way. Well, how do I mitigate the consequences of being a fool? Well, I learn, I ask for help, I seek wisdom. And so this is the Stoic process, like, if you really sort of zoom in on it, because once you ask these questions and you have this honest conversation with yourself, then you can come to that place of acceptance and sort of serenity.
And this is what we were talking about in a number of other conversations we had, and it really boils down to introspection. And that's what I enjoyed about that book series and why I always remembered it, is that the checks that he would have to do on a regular basis to make sure he hadn't hurt himself because he had no feeling in his limbs, it's the physical embodiment of introspection, right? I mean, that's what it is. And when you are self-aware enough that you can do introspection and kind of figure out what's going on with you, you can make sure that you're on the right track. You know, so is that part of Stoicism, Sam?
Most definitely. That one of the practices of Stoicism is daily reflection at the end of the day to think back upon all the events of the day, what your reactions were, what your perceptions were, what your actions as a result of the decisions that you made, all of those things. And the relevant part of that in 12-step recovery is the fourth step of where you take personal inventory, they call it, every day. Like, what did I do right? What did I do wrong? And it's not a practice in moral failure. It's a, more of a scientific, just step outside yourself if you can and go, well, that's interesting. I acted that way when that happened. You know, and I'll say that because I do this as a daily thing, I reap the benefits. I have a, I'm not trying to brag or anything, but I have the best marriage in the world. And because I'm kind of a bonehead and I didn't have the best marriage from the start. And this was the process. This is how I got there.
Well, when I think about people that need introspection into their morals, I think about Patrick. So what do you think, Patrick?
How do I respond to that?
What a horrible setup. But no, but seriously, what do you think about what we're talking about here, Patrick?
No, I mean, nodding along for the most part. I think some of the things you've said around, you know, that someone's, say, appearance or whatever can reflect, you know, their lifestyle. I think that's a little bit simplified, to put it just a bit. The second that you said that, I thought back to a talk that Sam, you gave years ago at Peers Conference. If I remember, one of the things that you said, which, tell me if this is stoicism or not, but, you know, be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a hard battle.
Yes.
I think, you know, to assume that if someone's a mess or they're whatever, it's, you know, it's because they haven't taken control of their life or whatever. I think that's really discounting what someone's history and what outside factors have done to a person's psyche and damaged a person. So I think it's also important to be aware that, you know, everyone has their limits as to how much they can control and the actions that they can take. And everyone's, you know, I always try to think everyone's doing their best. Like their best might suck at times, but people are doing their best.
I'm not always doing my best.
Well, you are. It's just sometimes it sucks.
No, I mean, I'm being honest. Like, there are definitely times where I'm not doing my best, you know? I mean, it depends on...
You aren't, but, you know, it's the best that you can muster at that point.
But it's the difference between blame and responsibility. When you're at the end of the day and you're reflecting back on your day, and if you weren't doing your best, if you were doing something that wasn't your best, one option is that you attack yourself, you blame yourself, and then you slip back into that spiral of fear. And the Stoic direction is that you say, oh, okay, why? Why was I doing right. this thing this way? And how? What am I pursuing that is not aligned with this way that I was being? And how do I take responsibility for that? Not in a self-blaming way, but in a self-responsible way.
Right. And I think being responsible, at least to me, is saying, you know what, honestly, I didn't do my best. Because I think there are times where I could say, well, I did my best, and it would be a cop-out, right? Because I probably, maybe I really didn't. But, you know, I want to address something that you said, Patrick. I'm not saying that there are not external influences that could change your lifestyle.
Oh, yeah.
Right? I'm just saying that your body reflects your lifestyle. There may be reasons for your lifestyle that are external factors. That's fine. I'm not saying that those things don't exist for people. I know that that's a thing. However, at the end of the day, your body reflects your lifestyle. And I'm not making a judgment about, you know, hey, you know, you haven't taken ownership of this or whatever. Cause, you know, for instance, like, I'm overweight. I could lose weight. I know that. Mm-hmm. I understand that there are more things that I could be doing that would be assisting with that, you know? So I'm not saying that there aren't a history of things that could have happened to someone or reasons why their lifestyle might be the way it is. I'm just mentioning the reality that your body is this machine that it reflects what you're doing, you know? And the reasons for what you're doing are kind of like a separate thing. At least
kind of a tautology, though. It's like, yes, I came to be the way that I am by doing the things that I did. Okay. I think to Patrick's point and to Stoicism's point, you can make those causal links within yourself. You can point to yourself and say, I am such a way. I would like to be a different way. How do I take responsibility for becoming? You know, what can I control? I think it's very rarely appropriate to make those causal assumptions about someone else.
The way that I was mentioning it was more for yourself.
And decide, right, you can look at yourself and make decisions about the way that
well,
that,
well, that's the whole point, though, Michael. So that's the whole point of what I was saying, was not to shame anybody, was to say, hey, if you want to make a change, the change you have to make is something on a daily, consistent basis. Like, that's what you need to do. And it's not meant as a, you know, external way of judging people. It's more for yourself, that if you actually want to make a change, what it's going to take is a change in your lifestyle, not taking a pill, not going on a fad diet. Like, you literally have to change your lifestyle, and your body will then reflect that. The same way that I think Sam was talking about, you need to change where your mentality is at in order to be able to change how you react to the things that happen around you. Does that make sense, Sam?
Yeah. And I just kind of want to leapfrog and take what Patrick was saying to the next level, is that I want to be careful. I am careful when I talk about stoicism, because there are people in the world who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders. And there are people who are just in a place where, because external things do happen to us that we don't have control over.
Right.
But what Stoicism offers is not so much an imperative to get over it. It's what Stoicism offers is a way out for somebody who is reasonably mentally there. But even then, if I can refer now to 12-step recovery, people with grave emotional and mental disorders do recover as well, they say, if they have the capacity to be honest. And that honesty is something akin to what Michael just described a little while ago about self-honesty. Like, when you approach something, it's like, okay, well, this is going to be hard and I'm anxious about it. But what that says about me is that I'm worried. I'm worried I'm going to lose my job. That's the, like, that's self-honesty, right? So Stoicism offers an antidote to what you might feel that you're trapped in, and you might not realize that it's possible to escape what you think is inescapable. Because certainly my story is one where there's no reason that I should have escaped what I did, but this lifestyle has certainly done that for me. And I think if it can do it for me, it can do it for anybody.
Well, there's another compelling story too, sort of along those lines, a guy named James Stockton. I don't know if you've ever come across him or read his story, but
absolutely. Classic Stoic.
Yeah. So he was an admiral in the U.S. Navy. He was shot down or somehow captured as a POW during Vietnam. And he was held there for 5 years in the worst imaginable conditions. And slowly, one by one, all of the POWs he was held with did not survive. But he did. And he credits his survival to Epictetus, which is, I think you mentioned him earlier, which is the famous Stoic philosopher, because he was able to he couldn't change his situation, but he had full control over his perception of the situation.
And that reminds me of something that I don't even know where I picked it up, but I learned many, many years ago, that you are giving words power, right? So if someone says a word, the impact that that word has is entirely up to the person that hears it.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, certain, you know, curse words or certain other words that people don't like or whatever, the only reason those have power is the person hearing it is affected by them. And it's something, you know, I talk to my kids about, is that, you know, you are in control over how you react to what is said and done to you. And if you allow yourself to be affected negatively by these things, you're giving power to the person who is saying this thing, or you're giving power to the person who is doing this thing to you. What do you think about that, Sam? Is that Stoicism?
That's exactly Stoicism. You basically quoted Epictetus again, who said that, I think it was him who said that if you feel harmed by somebody else, that your mind was complicit in the harm.
That's right. Yeah.
That's pretty much what you just said, for sure. Oh.
Okay. Well, I guess I know where I got it from then, somehow. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's funny because William B. Irvine talks about in his book, he says some people are what he calls just congenial Stoics, just born that way and just kind of get it. And I've always thought of you as that way, Andrew.
So, Sam, I wonder how you feel about, I guess this has kind of become like a trend in Silicon Valley too. So one of Epictetus's ideas is it's not what happens to you that matters, it's how you react to it. How do you feel about the practice of intentionally putting yourself in uncomfortable situations in order to practice that virtue? So, like, the most simple example I can think of, and I see it frequently cited online, is switching to taking ice cold showers, like giving up hot showers and only taking cold showers, so that you can practice this idea that you're in an uncomfortable situation, but it sort of forces you to work through it.
I did that for a while. I went through a cold shower phase, and it was great. Actually,
did you find value in that? Do you feel like that increased your resilience or?
I would say it's hard to say. It's psychosomatic probably, right? But even then, or like placebo effect, but probably, yeah. And also one thing that I do is that, especially in today, and I don't want to, you know, get into any controversial areas, but today is things are so highly politicized. And having conversations with people that are uncomfortable about politics, religion, and all of those things, I have friends that I hold on to dearly. I'll be a friend with anybody. I don't care what your ideologies are. I don't care what your religion is. I don't care which side of the political spectrum you're on. If you're a human, I care about you. And if you will be friendly with me, I'll be friends with you. And so I have people that I consider like brothers and sisters that I have conversations with about those difficult topics, more in a sense of not to debate and see who's right, but actually to sit there and listen and try to understand, because it's not just what a person from a different mindset says, but trying to step into their mind and see why they view it that way.
Right.
And when I do that, I'll admit that it is a very uncomfortable position to be in.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was a psychologist who had this idea that we all kind of have our own moral taste buds. So I'm swallowing something that doesn't necessarily taste good to me. So I expose myself to other ideas. So absolutely, I make a practice about exposing myself to situations, ideas, and things that make me uncomfortable on purpose.
Most people don't do that. Most people are in their own bubble. And it's the kind of thing where a lot of people thought, the internet and social media, what it's going to do for people is it's going to expose them to all these ideas. And this is great. You know, everyone is going to, the exact opposite happened is it allowed people to coalesce into these little tiny islands of, I'm going to go to the island where the tribe agrees with me 100% on this thing. And then they don't interact with anybody else.
Well,
with
it
any
also,
different, with any it different also made idea. It
to where people that had more outside the mainstream ideas could more easily communicate with each other.
Oh, yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, because you're able to find people, you know, maybe in your town, there's one person that thinks that licking the yellow frog is like the amazing thing, you know, and you're like, okay, well, yeah, I guess that's not
or
really
I was
thing.
I was thinking more along the lines of people who like think Hitler was a good guy.
Or
so like
whatever.
It used to be difficult to like find other people that shared those views. Right. The internet makes it a lot easier.
Right. And that's the thing. You're right. The internet allows these fringe groups to kind of coalesce together. And as I was saying, they don't typically interact with other groups at all. It's not this idea sharing wonderfulness. They don't really interact with these other groups unless they're attacking the other group. And then they marshal their support and then they attack and then they go crazy. I got a quote or a tweet that I want you to react to, Sam. Curious okay. to hear what you think about this. I thought this was really interesting. So the 24-hour news cycle has done to our parents what they thought violent video games and Marilyn Manson would do to us.
Oh, now that is interesting.
In other words, the constant banging and the tribalization of a lot of these news outlets, it's kind of causing people to, it's working people up into a frenzy, you know?
It does. And I read a headline, you know what I do is I read Pocket. And so I read lots of headlines, never the article. But one of the headlines I thought was interesting is that, or it was subtitle or first paragraph said that due to our hunter-gatherer origins, that our minds are wired to prioritize bad news. And
makes sense.
Yeah. And that's just a bad combination and that's why bad news probably sells ads. And it's a horrible situation to be in. And this is the world that we live in, right? And this is why I cling to stoicism for my sanity. And I actually don't watch the news.
I terminated my cable a long time ago. And the only thing I listen to is BBC World when I'm driving around in my car. That's like my news. And then occasionally Patrick will like message me links to stories that will upset me and I'll ruin my day, but that's about it. And I used to be this crazy news junkie, like keeping up with stuff like all the time. And then I went away for a while where I had no access to anything. I thought I missed out on everything. And I got back and the world didn't change. Like nothing changed. I looked around. I'm like, well, that was a load of shit. You know, that's the news is just a TV program trying to get ratings, trying to keep me watching. Screw this.
I think, you know? let's not bucket news too broadly, because we do depend on journalism. We depend on fact finding. We depend on other people to go investigate pieces of the world that we cannot ourselves be present to.
I'm talking about the 24-hour news cycle, sure. Like any of those 24-hour news shows is what I'm right. talking about.
And, yeah. and so then this kind of goes back to the quote that Sam was talking about earlier, where Epictetus was saying, make sure that you're responding, not reacting, and that what you're responding to is the reality of a thing and not an impulsive impression of the thing. And so I think right. going back to this sort of question of, well, what can I control? Well, I can control my reaction to the news, and mm-hmm. I can have this discipline of knowing and renewing my knowledge of my own mortality so that I'm not so afraid of the things on the fringe that sound threatening, and so I'm not as likely to react impulsively, and then I can sort of take my time, like Epictetus says, just take a sec and think about the nature of the thing and investigate the thing and then respond. And that's what I can control. I can choose my sources of news to be less reactionary, and I can cultivate my own self to be less reactionary.
To pull this back into the development world, that's something that you can, it sounds to me like you could also use this Stoic philosophy to do the same thing that you would do for the news, for, you know, the latest framework that's coming out, you know, to kind of take a more reserved look at it. Does that make sense,
Sam? Absolutely. That's brilliant. Absolutely.
Why don't you elaborate on that, Sam, a little bit about how Stoicism could relate to picking up the next shiny object that happens to be coming in the front end world and you know?
Exactly. Well, how about this? Is that you know that you're going to end up having to use that on whatever next project you get thrown into because somebody decided they're going to use it. And like now I'm in a world where I jumped into a world of Angular, the modern Angular, not Angular 1.
Mm-hmm. Sorry.
And React. And I'm not doing it. And also I'm doing Node. I'm not doing anything that I was used to before, which is PHP, like mm-hmm. LAMP stack stuff, and Vue.js, which is popular in the PHP world. Mm-hmm. And so I'm in a world now where I'm learning very quickly, and I'm learning how to learn. And some right. of that I learned, but I loved did you have an article, or you said something about learning how to learn is the best skill that you can think. That helped 100%. Me a lot. That yeah. article helped me a lot, actually, overcome some of that anxiety. But yes, the constant exposure could increase or anxiety because it's like, oh my goodness, I have to learn something again, or I'm going to be irrelevant. But then to Michael's point is that, like Epictetus said, there's a gap between impulse and response. And if you can extend that, that's where you find yourself. That's a concept I think about a lot. Some people, and certainly who I was many, many years ago, was somebody who thought that I was who my impulses are, right? But that wasn't who I am. There's some sort, if you can extend the gap between impulse and response, you can actually find out who you are. And that's a Stoic concept in that Marcus Aurelius talks about this at all. That nature, part of nature is reason, not just the things and the atoms that exist, but also reason. If you think about DNA, RNA, like there's information involved as well. And the ancients had this idea of the logos, and which is that what we share with nature is reason. And if we want to live according to nature, then we don't just live according to those knee-jerk responses. We're not just a bunch of atoms, but we also live by reason. Well, there's no time to reason unless you can extend that gap between stimulus and response.
And the interesting thing is that Epicurus is someone who was around, you know, what, like 300 BC or something like that, before the internet, before there was a crazy JavaScript front end. And yet, somehow what he was talking about applies, right? So that means we're talking about universal truths. And so I think that's what makes it valuable, you know, not just to the way you approach your work, your development, but also to the way you approach your life, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think it is important that you learn how to learn, as you mentioned, because that's what you're going to be doing most of your life and you look at the commonalities in terms of, you know, yeah, you were a PHP developer before, but you shouldn't define yourself by that, right? That just is like the language is just the conduit for problem solving. And yes, it takes a little bit of time to get up to speed on the language, but that's not the important part. The important part is the problem solving part. And you can get up to speed on that. And that gets back to what I was talking about before with regards to imposter syndrome, in that, you know, this is normal. Like, this is an everyday part of what you're going to be doing, that you're going to be doing stuff that you don't know exactly how to do it. And you just have to be able to understand that that is something that you need to deal with and move on, you know?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think, Patrick?
I'm down with it. Yeah.
I don't think Patrick's awake. I think he's sleeping through this.
No, this has been good.
I have really enjoyed hanging out with all of you. We've met at these conferences and we're part of the same community. And I just love you guys. I just wanted to just be all squishy and about that right now.
Love you too, Sam.
Oh, Sam.
Still not going to wear that little black dress for you, though, Sam. It's not happening.
Sorry. Marion, I didn't mean to leave you out with the guys thing.
I did not think about that with the guys thing.
I'm so sorry. I apologize. You're probably my favorite person here, and that's not even a lie because I do play favorites.
Marion is every person's favorite person here.
All right. So now we're not going to embrace stoicism anymore. We're going to embrace Spartanism, and you're going to have to throw yourself on your sword for your mistake, Sam.
Okay.
That's it.
Fair enough.
But that about wraps it up for another episode of the devmode.fm podcast. Make sure to subscribe. And if you enjoy the show, please write a review on iTunes. Tell a friend or retweet this episode. We'd really appreciate it. We'd also love to continue the conversation. Leave us a comment on the devmode.fm website or find us on Twitter at devmode.fm. For the devmode.fm podcast, I'm Andrew Welch.
I'm Jonathan Melville.
I'm Marion Nulevant.
Michael Rogg.
And I'm Patrick Harrington.
And thank you, Sam Hernandez from Precocity, for coming on.
My pleasure.
Patrick, do you think I'm going to be attacked by a squad of Karens now? You think it's
I think, yeah, we should have listened.
Inevitable.
Listener mail.
Complain to the man.
I should add a complain to the manager button on the site.
Amazing.
All right. Let me stop the recording here before it gets too crazy.